Hello there, and welcome to Innovators in Care. I'm your host, Ruben Bush, and this is the show where we sit down with thought leaders in health and social care to talk about the problems they're solving and how they're innovating to reduce system-wide pressure and improve patient outcomes. In episode 7, we sat down with Simon Love and Sarah Thornton to talk about the concept of optimized handling, what it is, how it works, and the benefits that it brings. Now today, for our final episode of season 1, we move into the acute environment. We're talking to Sharon Rinsland, moving and handling senior coordinator at East Kent Hospital's University Foundation Trust. We'll be discussing the innovations that Sharon is implementing and the role that moving and handling has in improving patient flow. Enjoy. So, hello Sharon, welcome to Innovators in Care.
Hello, nice to see you.
Very good. I wonder if a good place to start, Sharon, would be if you could tell us your backstory and how you started in the NHS and then how you got to your role now.
Yes, I'm going to go back a little bit further than that. The only reason I'm going to do that is because I come from a background which is quite unusual. So before I came into nursing 26 years ago, I was a full-time farmer. So driving tractors and combines.
Okay.
So manual handling was completely out the window. Because you
imagine.
Had to physically do it.
Mm.
But when my children were old enough to be off my hands and doing their own thing, I wanted to have a career. So I joined the NHS as a HCA. And obviously, I think manual handling, they couldn't get anyone else to do it because it was in the time just as link assessors were appearing. And they asked me to go on a manual handling course, which I thought was a induction that you have to do when you join the trust. No, it was a 5-day link assessor course. It blew my mind. However, because I've always been into sport and always known about body and muscle tone and very, very keen about balance, this really, really ticked every box. And I loved it from that day. But working on a ward as a HCA, I found extremely hard because being outside all summer and suddenly working nights and teaching staff how to move and handle patients as a link was quite challenging. So I went into imaging to work just days in imaging.
Yes, okay.
And that's where I trained as a mammographer. So I am a radiographer, mammographer background.
Yes,
but
okay.
But I always kept the manual handling. And because everybody knows me will know I'm a pain, I like change. And I like to implement that change. And obviously, I was after I finished my courses within radiography, hospitals approached me and said, come and work for us as a manual handling support advisor. And that's where it all started. I came back into this trust about 12, 13 years ago. I originally started in East Kent, but travelled Maidstone and Medway. So I've done a lot of work in other trusts, which I think is really important because it gives you a variety. This trust is 5 hospitals. I came back 12 years ago and I've just recently completed my master's in ergonomics.
Excellent. That's one of the more interesting career changes I've come across, I must say.
Very, very, very different. But and the reason I mentioned that was because manual handling is a very serious thing, obviously. We want to keep our staff and our patients safe. But manual handling isn't just about, oh, we mustn't lift this and we mustn't do that. It is all about the individual and the patient. And I hate it with a vengeance when you see someone walking up the corridor with a chair and they look at you and they run away putting it down, thinking, oh, shouldn't be lifting that. Well, actually, yeah. If you're only going to do it once and it's not too heavy, by all means. But you're going to do it 50 times today, then I'm going to tell you. So that's what I like about it. And I think the farming brought that bit out in me. We have to be practical.
Yes. Yeah, manual handling to outsiders can often seem all about what you shouldn't do. But in many ways, it's actually about what you should do, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the first thing you always hear from someone, if they're talking to a manual handler, sit up straight, keep your back straight. You always get it. I had it from one of the directors the other day. I just rolled my eyes and he went, oh, I take it you weren't impressed with that. No, not at all.
Okay. Thanks, Sharon. That's a very interesting background. As I think we all know, a big topic or buzzword in the NHS at the moment is patient flow. What can moving and handling or manual handling, what part does that department play in helping patient flow?
I'm going to answer the question first of all, the difference between manual handling and moving and handling, because I get asked all the time. And my perception of what it is manual. When we were back in the dark ages, when I first started 26 years ago, we didn't have fancy equipment. We physically had to lift and handle our patients the best way we can. So we basically took a lot of mobility away from our patients, not realising it, not meaning to, because no one comes to work to want to injure their patient. So we manhandled those patients. Today, we move those patients. We should be moving them with appropriate equipment to be able to get them moving. So that's the difference between the two of those. Moving our patients forward, it is all about getting our patients rehabbed, getting them. So manual handling needs to identify the right equipment. Again, I'm a great believer in, if you've got a manual handling advisor, they need to understand what's out there. The first time I ever went away to a national conference, and that was probably only about 15 years ago, so for my career being 26 years, I was blown away by all this equipment at National Back Exchange. Absolutely blown away and thinking, my goodness, that will make a difference if we could use that. And so I started to implement it and make those changes. And it made a big difference to our trust, because we actually started to see a reduction in legal cases from MSDs along with legal cases for patient injury.
Yes, okay. And I think you mentioned before when we spoke that people seem to perceive moving handling as just training, but actually it's a lot more than that. It's sort of at the forefront of patient safety, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. There is no law that says how much you've got to train. The HSC will not say to you, you have to be trained every single day. What the HSC will tell you, and that's where manual handling is from, is your risk. What's the level of your risk? You need to mitigate it. So if the risk is that someone's been injured on a ward and they've been moving the patient, whether it's the patient or the staff member, are they trained in the piece of equipment they're using? That's what they'll ask. So I am, again, I keep saying this word only because I'm very passionate about what I teach, is that taking someone out of a classroom, taking someone off a ward and sticking them in a classroom and going through training, that person will enjoy that session but won't remember much about it when they get back on the ward, because it's a day out. This, and I'm not talking about induction here, anybody new coming into the trust does need induction, and they do need a classroom-based session for that, because you need to take them away to teach them some of the baselines of what we're working with. But with everything else, it should be competency-based training on every piece of equipment that is relevant to that ward. So there's no good training someone on a hoist if they haven't got one. So what a waste of time. So since doing that training needs analysis with our teams, we're finding that the compliance rate is so much better. We were 87% compliant with our training and 77% through COVID, because we didn't stop. So that worked really, really well. So that worked for us, doing it that way. Therefore, freeing up some of my team to be out investigating datexes and incidents and things like that. So you can't do this stuff if you're in a classroom all the time. You physically can't.
Yes, absolutely. And also, I think with a lot of the challenges with patient flow being around discharge, I think you mentioned before about doing work to make sure that moving handling is done as it could then be done in the community.
Yeah, we've got this real habit and have done for many years, and it's not a fault for manual handling, it's just the way we've done things, and nobody likes change. But if you look at the way we handle some of our patients, still where it'll take two staff maybe to possibly stand a patient, when in fact it could be done with one, it could be that this patient in the community has been using a particular piece of kit and they come in hospital and that gets taken away from them. And then we're standing them together. So this patient loses that confidence in that piece of kit, or deteriorates or deconditions because they're not utilising the muscles they would have done. And then they go home and then we struggle to get that patient back. So we should be looking at a flow that's utilising the same equipment and working together. That doesn't mean to say everything the community is using is right, and that doesn't mean to say everything the trust is using is right. It's about talking and saying, well, actually, why is our paperwork different? Why is that stand aid different, you know, and work as one instead of two separate entities, because that's what we do.
Yes. Okay, thanks, Sharon. So now moving on to sort of what you're doing now and working on for the future. What new innovations are you working on in terms of improving the patient experience?
We've just finished and working with our resus teams and falls teams with this. We're quite a large site, 5 hospitals, and quite, as most hospitals are, lots of parking areas within the hospital grounds, and not necessarily those parking areas are ours, they're maybe outsourced, where we have patients collapsing in the car park. And what would normally happen, the patient would collapse in the car park and an ambulance would be called because they're not on our property, which is utter ridiculous, because the poor ambulance crew, why do they want to come to a clinical setting and leave someone in the home when they're at short resources? So I worked with the resus team and the falls team to look at, we've got to improve this. Plus also, we were being told by some of the teams, well, we're not insured to go and get them out there. So I looked into it legally, and we were insured. There was nothing to do. I think it was just one of these Chinese whispers. So we looked at how we can improve it. So what we actually did was, we have pieces of equipment that can bring patients up off the floor, and we needed extra supporting trolleys that are very similar to what our ambulance crew use. So we bought all of this equipment in, and we now train our porters on a bleep. So when they get that call to say someone has fallen in the car park, they would then go and get the equipment. The trauma team would be the first team called. So they would go out, and then they would bleep the porter to tell them what equipment they need to bring. Now, the success story of that is, we'd had several falls in the past and they could have been in the car park for an hour to 2 hours, which is really sad. Now, we had one actually 2 weeks ago, and the patient was moved within 10 minutes and round in A&E and successfully gone home. So, you know, people come into hospital, get worried, they get anxious, don't they? They fall. We're like it ourselves if we're going for a procedure. So that's one of my favourite things, I think, with the Trust, because we're not just looking after our patients now, we're looking at our visitors.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really simple solution. We can often overcomplicate things and can't do this because of this legal reason or this isn't our job. But actually, just by proactively finding a solution and make it simple, it's something that improves patient care, isn't it?
I am that sort of person, actually. I'm a problem solver. If you give me something to do, I will try and find a way. I might not come out with all the right answers, and I might not get it right the first time, but believe me, I won't leave it alone until I find a solution, because that's what it's about, and that's what makes my job interesting, and that's why I love working with people to do it.
Absolutely. And in that specific instance, we know the data and the information about long lives. Car parks aren't particularly comfortable places, are they? You get an old person laying on there, and like you said, if you get to them in 10 minutes, they'll be fine, they go home. If they're lying on the ground for a couple of hours, then start to get pressure damage and perhaps even acute kidney failure, and then they're in hospital for a lot longer. It could have been avoided.
Yeah, it could even be fatal. So, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And I think you're also doing some work around early mobilisation and single care handling. Can you say a bit more about that?
Yeah, we've taken that on, obviously, working a lot with our community teams and the Kent Back Exchange, along with the National. We've looked at ways that we handle our patients. And I think manual handling could become very robotic, not meaning to, because we're doing it the right way and we're following the processes. However, you know, that robotic way is not always the right way, as we've said earlier. So we've looked at manual handling itself, and we have decided, as a trust and my team, along with my Kent group, we've looked at actually what do we class as single care and what do we class as two handler or three handler. And because I link quite a lot now with the community, I sit on their prescribing teams for equipment, which is great because I see equipment I didn't see in the trust. I think, oh, why haven't we got that? So that works quite well. But the nice thing about it is we are now looking at not induction. Our induction is a baseline. They have to have a basic level of training and understanding. But our general ward staff, they would be taught things like how to move the patient on their own. And the reason we've done this is because we're all 100% aware that the hospitals are at capacity. Our nursing staff, we don't have the nursing staff we had before, unfortunately, which is really sad because I'm proud to be in the NHS. But so they're trying to do the best they can. And if you've got a patient in a bed and you need two or three nurses to move them, they're more than likely going to do poor practice moving that patient than they would do if you implement something with a piece of equipment they could do it on their own. So we started to implement that and push it forward. And we actually did it in A&E yesterday when we got told we ain't got time to put those two slide sheets in like that. We were really too busy. We never use slide sheets. So we showed them a way that they could do it that was easy for them. And we made them think it was their idea. It's always a good thing. Positive thinking. And it worked because now I saw them doing it. It's great. So single care inside a trust where it's got its place and all through risk assessment is where we're pushing and where we're going with it. And the importance of that is to keep the patient mobilised, because by the time you're waiting for the two or three nurses, they could have been laying there for 2 or 3 hours. That 2 or 3 hours is a massive impact on the patients when they're deconditioning and they're unwell.
Absolutely. Okay, so moving on now to bariatric care, Sharon. We know it's becoming more and more of a problem nationally. How is that affecting what you're doing and your trust?
Bariatrics is something that's always been close to my heart anyway. I've worked with some very, very good people within bariatrics, within manual handling, and learnt a lot from them. So ever since being in the trust, I've always recorded, I am what's known as the data queen. If you haven't got evidence, you can't prove anything. So I like to collect evidence. So I've been collecting data possibly for the last, I would have said, 8 years of how many bariatric patients are coming in and how many are being discharged and what level of their mobility and so on. So I can give you that data up for the last year. And I've seen a huge trend in the last 4 years how it's grown massively. We had a decrease, obviously, through COVID, but then I expected that because most people were frightened to come in hospital. But then a massive increase after COVID because they were then very sick. And we were finding that they were prolonged. I think the biggest problem we are personally having is not so much with how we're managing them, because we've got a real stringent way and a way we work with them. We have fantastic bariatric beds. It's about space with us, because when you're up at hospitals at capacity where your A&Es are overflowed, you've now got extra beds on wards. So you've now got to find a space for a bariatric. And a bariatric ideally needs 2 bed spaces with a gantry if they're that immobile, so that you can get them up as soon as possible, because they're 10 times faster in degenerating and deconditioning. So we need to keep them moving. So that is our biggest problem. Our biggest challenge is that one. I think the other challenge is when we find them the space and we get them ready to be discharged, because they're not single care, or they're double care, it's very, very difficult to put them back into community, because they've also got their issues around how many carers or what package they can put them into, depending on the level of staff that they've got. But then equally, we're also seeing that they can't go back into their own homes because their own homes aren't suitable. So, and there isn't anything. So sometimes we're seeing, we've had patients in since April and they become bed blockers. And that's not their fault. You know, the patient doesn't want to stay in that long. They want it sorted. But I would have said the biggest money waster in the NHS is not having the right resources of how we manage these processes going forward.
Yes, okay, because I remember you saying that it costs £400 to £500 a day.
About £450 a day plus, yeah, a day to keep them in. And that's without the equipment. So you're hiring equipment in because, again, as acute trust, we've got some of our own. We've got all our own beds. We do rent in from the same company the beds if we haven't got enough. So we've got a good process and we've got bariatric rental companies. But we rent in all that equipment. So you've not only got that cost of keeping someone in, you've got the cost of the extra staff caring for them. You've got the cost of not being able to put someone else in that bed space. You then also got the cost of hiring the equipment. So you've got all of those aspects, let alone the poor family who want their loved one back who can't. So all of those are huge, and an awful lot of money is wasted for not having processes, which if someone was just to take a step back and look at what we need, you know, I'm a great believer in rehab gyms, you know, hospitals, rehab gyms, not nursing. I'm talking about somewhere they go, they're rehabbed, and then they're managed going forward out of the hospital. So the hospital comes back to being acute.
Yes, okay. That's interesting. It'd be very interesting to hear in perhaps a bit more detail about what you've mentioned a few bits there, but very, very interested to hear in more detail what you're doing to sort of combat and solve that problem.
Well, within the Kent Group itself, just recently, we're going to start a bariatric forum. Because I was involved recently also with the fire teams and ambulance teams, looking at how do we get these patients out, how do we get them back in, let alone out? What equipment can we put in? So I think we solved the issue working together about what's a good piece of kit that will help us move our patient with less staff. And we all know that if you've got a bariatric patient of, say, 44 stone in a bed, you are going to take 8-plus nurses trying to roll that. And you haven't got 8-plus nurses. So having the right bed possibly that turns, possibly having a gantry and all the other bits, you can reduce that down to possibly 3 staff utilising and going back to that equipment thing again. So we think we've got that right. The bit we need to do the joined up thinking with is looking at working with councils, working with government, looking at the teams who are looking after them in their homes and making sure our care package fits with what they're doing and not the other way around. We both need to be working together. So we are moving that forward. We're trying to work with our ambulance crews and teams to think, well, actually, what is it we could do to get the patient back in the house or out of the house safely? Because I'm even finding with some of our ambulance crew, we show them equipment, they go, I didn't know we had that. Oh, that's brilliant. So, and I think, and I am going to bring this into the mix, because this is one of the reasons why, as conference director, we've brought that into play a lot at conference this year. So we are going to be problem solving those issues, because there's a lot of experts in their field that's going to be there, and they may come up with something I've not even thought of, because we don't know everything. So because of those issues, that's what we're trying to do to make it different, make it better.
Yes, okay, that's good. That's very interesting. Okay, so we know the NHS and particularly ANE departments are at capacity a lot of the time now. How does that affect patient flow and what you're doing in manual handling?
It affects it hugely. You know, if you think about if an A&E, most A&Es, and not just our trust across the board, have got beds in it rather than trolleys because we are so busy. And the knock-on effect from that, it means that to clear our A&Es, we're having to put extra beds on wards. So where you might have an 8-bedded bay, you've now got a 10-bedded bay, which can be pretty difficult. And when I first saw that, the impact was huge. Because what that meant was when you're handling a patient and you've got another bed almost behind you, you can't move properly. So that is going to affect posture. And I'm actually doing recordings as we speak to look at seeing if our MSDs increase because of it. When I first flagged it, because I sit inside fundamental, so I sit on the fundamental report meeting, I sit with patient safety, teacher of ability, and all of those meetings, I flagged it as a health and safety issue around posture care. And also deconditioning of our patients, because if you haven't got space, how are you going to get the patient out? How are you going to get the equipment? And right down to our A&Es, if you've got bed in front of bed in front of a bed, how is this patient at the back going to be nursed in a way to get them moving and so on? So there was this huge knock-on effect. So we came up and did a risk assessment of the ward, and it, within a ward environment, it meant changing the way we work, and none of us like to do that. Because we had one particular ward, we did the risk assessment and we said, right, instead of taking 3 linen carts into the room to change your bed sheets, take 1. You know, don't take 3 because you haven't got the space. Look at the risk of your patients. So if you've got to put an extra bed in, if your patients are all mobile and getting in and out of their bed, they're probably going to be less likely going to need the chair because they're in and out, up and about and going down to the day room. But the patients who need the chair, who need the mobilisations, cannot have the extra bed space. So we manage it, and that's how we managed it through the risk. And we seem to be keeping on top of it, touch wood, as we speak. However, with A&E, we've looked at that differently. We've looked at the type of trolleys we've got, which are amazing, fantastic trolleys we've got in A&E. However, we're bringing beds in because we're having to leave them on the trolleys longer than we should do, and we're at risk of pressure damage. So we're looking at trolleys now with pressure relieving things in. We're looking at trolleys that profile like a bed. We're looking at trolleys that go really low that can weigh our patients. So it almost acts the same as a bed. So which means we can reduce space by utilising that trolley instead of beds being in A&E. We're just starting the trials on that now.
Yes, okay. And I think sort of with moving, handling in somewhere like Ely, when staff are under pressure, it can often lead to tunnel vision, can't it? Which I guess is moving and handling's responsibility to try and...
Yeah, it's very easy to become overwhelmed. We do audits. You know, again, I'm an audit queen. I need to know what the problem is. And I like to think I am one of these people, no matter how senior we are, right down to our cleaner, that they can approach and go, I've got a problem and I need to talk about it. Manuel Hanning here sits in occupational health, and I'm a great believer in health and wellbeing. And that's everyone across the board. So we do need to talk to them. At the end of the day, we're changing the way they work. And who are we to come in and say, you've got to do it our way? What makes us perfect? We're not. So we need to work with them and go, well, actually, okay, if this isn't working, what will work? But what I won't tolerate is, well, we're not doing it. Because that is not the case. We need to problem solve. Because I often put to them, well, actually, okay, I understand how you're feeling, but what if that was your mum at the front door? And we want to do it your way because that's the way we've always done it. So we've got to turn your mum away because we've got no space for her. And your mum dies. How would you feel? So we have to look at how can we do this together? How can we find a solution? I will give you the Manuel Hanning side. Let's look at how we can manage this ward, how we manage this A&E that's safe for our patient and safe for the staff. But let's not be negative, because that's going to make you feel down in the dumps. Let's be positive. And a box of sweets goes a long way.
I can well imagine it does. It does. So I know, Sharon, that a lot of trusts are facing financial challenges. What are you doing to justify getting the equipment you need?
I think we've always had to justify why we need it. And I think manual handling is one of those fields where people think, oh, it's just manual handling. Don't worry about it. Sit up straight. You know, bend your knees, because that's what we're all about. So we have to prove everything, because no one wants to waste any money. And there's an awful lot of money wasted in the NHS that really doesn't need to be wasted. So what we do as a trust, I sit on groups like medical devices. So if there's a piece of equipment, for argument's sake, let's just talk about these A&E trolleys that we just spoke about. If we need something like that, then it's my duty to put it onto a portal to say I'm requesting a trial for this piece of kit. And then we have to do the tender process like everyone else does. We all have to do that for legal reasons. But what I have to do, so let's just say it gets the file, we trial it, and we think, oh, this is amazing, we love it. And then ball goes, we ain't got any money, you can't have it. So it's a total waste of time. So we then look at data, and I'm a great, as I said before, I am a data queen. I will look at accidents and injuries, first of all. I will look at how many people have been injured doing a certain thing. I will look at how many patients have been injured. I'll check through patient safety to see if there's any issues that are building. I also sit on a meeting where we look at STICE incident reporting, so any accidents and injuries inside the trust to do with falls, manual handling and tissue viability. I sit on those meetings so I can log some of the reasons why something happens. I'll look at musculoskeletal disorders and how many staff have gone off sick. So, and then I will put a report together with highlighting all that stuff and tell them this is what they're spending, this is what their sickness pay is, this is what they're paying out, this is what they're hiring in to cover these areas. Where if you bought this piece of kit, you've reduced all of that, which is going to be less than that. And then you can bet your bottom dollar, as in the past, someone's going to come up and go, nah, because they haven't read half the report. But it's documented. So I then decided to go away and take photographs, cutting details of the patient out, showing images of how it's being managed. Because no disrespect for our senior board members who work just as hard as everyone else, they don't always see what's on the shop floor. Because they can't, physically can't get there. When they see things like that, it really does open their eyes and they go, maybe we need to think about this, especially when you put the risk on the risk register, because we can't mitigate it any more than we've done. So you've got all of these aspects together, and then they go, we probably need to spend that money. And then 9 times out of 10 do. But again, that goes back to our question right beginning of the day, where who has the time to do all of that? Well, when I first come in the trust, I didn't have time to do all that either, because all I was doing was training. But as I said, there's no law about how much training you do. And if you don't get your priorities right, they're never going to change. You'll always just be training. It's about making sure you cover every aspect and also being seen. You're not just a manual handler. Manual handling in this trust now sits with patient safety. It sits with tissue viability, sits with fundamentals care. It sits with discharge. Nobody in this trust does anything without speaking to me first with regards to manual handling, which I think is amazing. Absolutely amazing, because they've realised manual handling is fundamentally part of patient safety and risk.
Yes, absolutely. I think that elevates it, doesn't it?
Massively.
And shows how, as a profession and its importance, how that's progressed.
Yeah, because I think manual handling once upon a time was all about the staff. It was all about musculoskeletal. Well, actually, musculoskeletal should be being reduced. Because if you're using equipment, you're not physically... It's a bit like going back to working on a farm. You know, I'm not lifting those bags. My forklift's doing it. So it's the same in a hospital. You know, if my patient can't move themselves, then under the HSC, we should be reducing it as much as possible by putting things in place to reduce that risk. And if we're not, as an employer and an employee, we can be ultimately responsible. So why aren't we doing that? Because we're still going up the same road as we've done for many years. It's about breaking away, making the change, and being heard. Believe me, I like to be heard.
Excellent. Okay, so moving out a bit further ahead now, Sharon. If you were in charge of moving and handling at NHS England, what would be your priorities?
My priorities would be to standardise. You know, we have got over 200 NHS hospitals across the country, and everyone is different. Why? You know, our patients might move in a different way because of their complex needs, but the standard shouldn't be any different. The process shouldn't be any different. So why are they? Why? We're all one NHS. It's all one funding, all coming from one government. So why is it different? So having a standard way we're going to do something, having a standard way of what equipment and how we use it, having a standard process for buying the equipment, because it's very different for every single trust. Having a standard way of training, because you've got some fantastic trainers out there, but you've equally got trainers that don't have that level of ability. Not through their own fault, it's because they've not been given it because there's no money, don't see it as important. And so they're put on the back burner all the time, money's put somewhere else. So standardisation, management, equipment, risk assessment, policy. Your policy for each trust should be the same. Why is my policy any different from Maidstone and Medway? It works the same. So having that, you have it in tissue viability, you have it in falls. Manual handling, not at all. We're very, very separated. That would bring an awful lot together and save an awful lot of money. And having it regulated. And believe me, if I was in NHS England, it would be regulated.
I can well imagine. Yes, okay. Those points are very interesting, those priorities. How do you see that playing out in terms of the next, say in 10 years' time, where do you think that would put moving and handling?
Fundamentally, at the forefront of patient safety. And that's where it needs to sit. Because when you look at our patients, majority of incidents and injuries, when you dig deep through root cause analysis, you find somewhere along the line it's something that we've done without meaning to when we're handling the patient. It might be from a simple bruise on an arm where we shouldn't be grabbing. It might be from failing to put a slide sheet in so we get a tear of the skin, right down to not connecting a hoist properly where the patient falls. So all of those aspects that injure that patient is through manual handling. Having one complete standard of, well, why did you deviate? Why did you move off? Why did you do it that way? And yes, you're always going to get the odd person who does something slightly different. You've got to allow for small movements, but not that actually, why is it taking six staff to move that patient when the trust needs to bring in the equipment in to do that? So 10 years' time, I'd like to think that we are so far in front that we take manual handling more seriously, because we don't. We just think of it as musculoskeletal for staff. And yes, that's important. Our staff need to be happy and they need to be safe. But I'm a great believer in that it's gone away more from musculoskeletal and more into our patient safety zone.
Yes.
I know our trust in general, since sitting on the fundamentals, when we talk about incidents, because when I first started on the fundamentals, if I'm honest, they didn't think manual handling should be part of it. So we had tissue ability, we had fetch control, all of those, we had governance, patient safety, all on it. I wasn't invited. I was most put out. So I spoke to them. And they asked me to attend, didn't ask for a report. They asked me to attend so I could see what they talked about. And most of those subjects linked to me. Most of them linked into manual handling, some way or form. So I said, can I bring a report next time and I'll show you how I can resolve some of those issues you just talked about. And the next time I came, they let me read my report. And I've been going ever since. So that's where I see it. I see people need to realise how important it is and what it stands for. And we need that good standard of manual handling across the country for it to be as strong as it needs to be.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier, Sharon, about the MBE conference coming up soon. Can you tell us a bit about what people can expect and why they should come along?
Yeah, well, I am conference director, I sit on the board. As you can see completely through this interview, that I have talked about the importance of keeping motivated and moving and ensuring that we're trained enough to do what we need to do and we need to problem solve. Conference this year is all about that. You know, I've ripped it to pieces and taken on board an awful lot of evaluations from last year's conference and put an awful lot of things in place. So it's called Hands On, Let's Get Practical. And what's going to happen is there are going to be workshops. We've got a couple of preliminaries, about three or four preliminaries, that's all. The rest will be hands-on workshops. And what we're trying to do within it is, one, without our exhibitors, we would not run conference. So we need to support our exhibitors and they need to support us. We need to work together. And going back to that talk earlier on where we talked about equipment, again, we need to link it into that. So our conference is all around, each person running their workshop has got to have a case study. And that case study has to be about a problem that they've had at some stage. And then they have to talk to the exhibitors and get lots of different bits of kit in there. So if it's, let's just say it's something like a fall, so they're going to go around to all our exhibitors collecting each bit of kit that relates to a fall and put it into the room. Our exhibitors can be in there, but they're not allowed to say anything. And then we're going to go through the scenario and the people in the conference itself, that in that room, have to problem solve. And it's no one pointing the finger and thinking, oh my God, did I see him do that? Because probably somebody else has done that. And that's the whole point of it, it's problem solving. So every session will be around that. The aim is we've got workflows going through. So we've got acute settings, community settings, paediatric, bariatric, evacuation, including ambulance evacuation from a home and into a hospital. So we've tried to cover all the things that are massively giving everyone a problem this year and getting hands-on and getting everybody practical. I'm quite excited about it, if I'm honest. And I'm really, really pleased that our exhibitors' spaces are full. So if anyone's out there listening to me, get yourself booked on, because you are going to miss a smashing confident conference.
Yes, and we will indeed be there. So looking forward to it. Okay, so to round off now, Sharon, something a little bit different. Could you tell us a story about when you've had the biggest positive impact on a patient's life?
I've got a good few, actually, but there's one in particular that does stick into my head. We had a very sick patient come into one of our wards, and she was in so much pain that the tissue viability contacted me and asked for my expertise, that every time she was moved, they couldn't put slide sheets in. She was in so much pain that it just couldn't work. And no matter how much I tried to get the pain under control, it wasn't happening. So I went in and I wanted to pop her onto a turning bed, because I felt that actually if we can't do it, then the bed will do it for her, and to at least get her moving enough to stop her from deconditioning. So we didn't have the turning beds in the hospital at the time. It was, well, we do on our ITU, but we didn't actually have on general wards. So I brought it in and we put it under this patient and we started to see improvement. And then we started to experiment a bit more with the turning bed. So we then started to use it to stand the patient up and we got a standing and eventually discharged home. Now, I went to the trust and said, oh, business case, the story we talked about earlier, can we have some of these? And it will be tissue viability and manual handling, who only let them go out. So we'll sign them off to say, oh, yeah, definitely this patient, and we'll put training in to make sure. And we got told, actually, there isn't that much money, but we'll have a look. And then I got this lovely email from charities to say the gentleman's, the wife's husband came forward and bought us those beds because it made a massive difference to his wife's life and how her recovery, and that's all she spoke about, was this fantastic bed that made her feel so much better. And that gave me this biggest smile to think, we made that difference. So that's why I go back to that. Don't ever say equipment. Look what's out there. Yes, it's fantastic bits of kit out there. And we don't always know what's... And that's why, again, conference is so important, because that's where you see it. If you don't go, how do you know what's there?
Indeed, that's a really heartwarming story, isn't it?
I loved it. You know, I've got so many, but that one stuck. I'm very passionate about manual handling, as you know. And most people out there who hopefully you see this will know me and know how passionate I am. But I would not be able to do everything that I do without the strong team I have behind me. And I have an amazing team here at East Kent. And I'm not just talking about my team in manual handling. I'm talking about our tissue viability, our falls, all of those team, and right down to our leads who give me the time to sit strategically and fight those battles. So I'm really grateful for that here at East Kent Hospitals.
And a lot of the improvements that you're implementing wouldn't work without other teams buying in and the collaboration.
Exactly. And I think everyone gets bad press. It happens, unfortunately, and that's really sad. But sometimes when we look at the good things that are going on, we don't always take the notice that we should do. We always want to talk about bad. And there's some fantastic stuff happening in this trust, amazingly stuff that are happening that don't get recognised. So it's important to me to mention that and mention the teams that do it. And because we work so collaboratively with falls, tissue viability, infection control, and even our directors of nursing, because we all talk to each other, we're coming up with some fantastic ways of helping our patients. And I think that's win-win.
Absolutely. That's excellent. Thanks very much, Sharon. It's been an absolutely fascinating conversation. And we've covered a lot of different topics there, haven't we? It's been very insightful and I've enjoyed it a lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Sharon is always fascinating to listen to, and this was no exception. I think there was one key point that I took from this episode, which is that moving and handling has a very important role to play in the hospital environment, and that actually is at the forefront of patient safety. So, that's episode 8 of Innovators in Care. As mentioned, this brings season 1 to a close. Over the last 8 episodes, we've heard from innovators from across health and social care, learned about many new concepts and ideas, and had a good laugh along the way. Thank you to each of our guests who have given us their time and expert insight and opinions. And thank you very much to each and every one of you who has watched and listened to this series. It's been good to have you along for the ride. Thank you and goodbye.